I suppose I knew that, she said quietly. Of course, that only confirms my suspicions about that little postscript on the kidnapper's letter.
What do you mean?
If they won't let your father receive mail, I hardly think they would have let him write a letter to his family. I'm sure they wrote it.
It was clearly Dad's handwriting.
I don't mean so much the physical act of putting pen to paper. He may have written it, but they composed it.
I disagree. Those were his own words. I'd bet my Jeep on it.
How can you be so certain?
Because of the way he expressed himself toward me.
But it was so short, it was long enough for me to know.
She gave me a curious look.
What are you trying to tell me, Nick?
Look at it this way. Let's say that a kidnapper is writing a letter that he hopes will pass for a letter written by a father to his son. If he's going to do it right, the ghostwriter has to step into the shoes of the father. For all the father knows, this letter could possibly be the last words he ever conveys to his son. As a ghostwriter, you'd probably throw in three little words, I love you. You'd do that because that would be normal, right?
Mom blinked. Depends on what you mean by normal.
Exactly, because normal in this house doesn't mean a father telling his son, I love you. Normal is what Dad wrote. Nick, give my love to Lindsay when you see her and take good care of your mother and grandmother. She looked at me with soulful eyes. That I'd committed his impersonal message to memory told her that I'd given it much thought, that it had affected me.
You know your father loves you.
I suppose I do, yes, but it would be nice to hear it.
That's a two-way street.
You're right. We've never been great communicators. That's what makes me sadder than anything. In the last few days, I've come to realize that in my entire life, I've never had an honest conversation with my father.
Your father doesn't lie to you.
I don't mean honest in the George Washington sense. I mean honest as in intimate, two people bearing their souls.
Your father doesn't have many of those conversations with anyone.
I thought for a second. The kitchen was suddenly so quiet I could hear the hum of the refrigerator. I hadn't intended to raise the issue of the FBI tonight, but this seemed like an opportunity.
Mom, how much do you know about the Nicaraguan end of the fishing business? Some.
How well do you know Guillermo?
Actually, I've met Guillermo only once. We hardly said two words to each other.
She said it with conviction. Almost as if she didn't want to know Guillermo. Or maybe I was reading too much into it.
Do you trust him? He's been your father's partner for over a decade. And I don't see anyone else volunteering to run to Colombia to deal with the local police on behalf of the family.
No doubt he's been a help.
Did something happen that makes you not want to trust him?
I was thinking of Agent Hewitt and his accusations, of course. But Mom seemed stressed enough without taking her down that path.
It's just that you don't know him. I don't know him.
You get right down to it, we don't know Alex either. Someone from the family should be on the front line.
You still want to go to Bogota, don't you?
Yes.
She shook her head, almost groaning. Why? I just told you. I don't think you did.
She seemed to sense there was something I hadn't told her.
It's hard to explain, I said. Try.
This kidnapping has made me stop and realize that something's missing between me and Dad, always has been missing. I have respect for him. He's courageous, strong, all that. Growing up, I'd always thought I wanted to be like him. Not necessarily a fisherman, but like him nonetheless. The last few nights, I've stayed awake wondering if we really are at all alike, and it's occurred to me I don't know him that well. And he doesn't know me either. Maybe that's why it's so important that I go on this trip. Find him. Maybe we can introduce ourselves. From her pained expression, it was clear that she still didn't want me to go, but she finally seemed to understand.
I don't know what I would do if I lost both of you. Please, be very careful.
I reached across the table and held her hand. I will. I promise.
Chapter 18.
It was their third camp in 7 days. Or maybe it was 8 days, Matthew wasn't sure. The gorillas had stolen his wristwatch, his only calendar. At least a week had passed since they'd reached the mountains, almost two since the shootout in Cartagena. They'd traveled by foot and by mule, mostly climbing, but at times descending at angles as steep as 40 degrees. More than once he was certain that they'd doubled back and covered the same ground. The exercise seemed designed to disorient the prisoners and discourage escape. Surely it had nothing to do with casting confusion to possible rescue teams. With guerrillas in control of almost half the country, a Rambo mission was out of the question. Even if these particular kidnappers weren't formally aligned with any Marxist group, the army would still have to beat back more organized leftist forces like FARC and the National Liberation Army, and then literally climb a mountain to free Matthew and the others. Fat chance. The captives numbered six now, counting Matthew and the Colombian daddy and mommy that Joaquin had bargained away from FARC to help prevent his escape. 2 nights ago, Joaquin and his team had joined camp with another band of rebels who had three other prisoners in custody. Those guerrillas were apparently part of Joaquin's group, as they all obeyed his orders. Initially, Matthew hadn't known what to make of it. During a bathroom break, it was again Emilio, the Colombian daddy, who'd explained.
"It's their division of labor," he said. "One team specializes in the abductions. The other focuses on housing and guarding the prisoners."
The three new prisoners, Matthew learned, weren't new at all. A Swede and a Canadian were in their second month of captivity, having been abducted together from a mining project near the Ecuadorian border. The Canadian was from Saskatchewan, a strapping, confident cowboy at heart who acted more like a Texan. The Swede was more reserved, more bitter about the whole experience. So far, the only thing he'd told Matthew about himself was his name, Jan Lunden. The body language, however, seemed to place blame on the Canadian for the mess they'd gotten into. The third new prisoner was another Colombian, a banker who'd simply driven down the wrong road on his way to work one day, 16 months ago. Time in captivity had taken its toll on him. Pants that had once fit him now gathered around his waist. A thick beard covered his face, hiding the sunken cheeks. His skin was dry and flaky, the worry lines on his forehead seemingly carved in wax. His long hair was tangled in knots and a strange shade of orange. Hair wasn't naturally that color on any human being. It had to have been malnutrition. Most shocking of all, he was just 38 years old. His appearance had left Matthew speechless, which was just as well, since the prisoners were rarely allowed to speak to one another. That wasn't Joaquin's rule. The edict had come from Aida, a 13-year-old girl who seemed overeager to use her M1 30-caliber carbine. Aida was the low-level gorilla designated to deliver meals to the prisoners, usually potatoes and a few beans. Routinely, she'd drop most of it on the ground while serving, feigning clumsiness. It was always intentional. She clearly relished her power over the captives, and she asserted it by spilling their small rations of food and giggling about it, or by enforcing stupid rules, like no talking during meals. Matthew surmised that females, especially young girls, were low in the pecking order in Joaquin's group. Aida took it out on the prisoners, the only ones lower than she was. For the third consecutive evening, the six ate in silence under Aida's watch. A total of six guards were on duty, but everyone except Aida was busy trying to see who, with a flick of the wrist, could stick a hunting knife into a tree stump from 4 meters away. One of their buddies was on the other side of the stump, sleeping off a hangover. It was typical behavior from these fools. Knives, guns, and grenades were all sources of amusement, all handled like toys without regard for anyone's safety. "Idiotas!" shouted Sleeping Beauty, adding a stream of choice words. An errant throw had landed the knife in his lap. Luckily, it was the blunt end and not the blade. The others laughed as he stormed off to the hut. The hut was where the gorillas slept, men and women together. It was possible that the gorillas had built it themselves, but Matthew thought it more likely that it had been taken by force from mountain peasants. With mud walls and a crude thatched roof, it looked like something a primitive Indian tribe might have constructed 10,000 years ago. It didn't even have a chimney.
A fire burned constantly to combat the cold mountain air, and smoke escaped through an open window. It reminded Matthew of the little shacks the Mosquito Indians built along the Nicaraguan coast to smoke fish. Only the mosquitoes were smart enough not to smoke themselves. The guards were still laughing, passing around a bottle. It was practically a nightly ritual, parties at sunset. A few swigs of rum, followed by basuco, a cheap and plentiful byproduct of cocaine processing that would make them crazy out of their minds. One of the male gorillas caught Aida's eye from across the camp. She smiled in return, interested. She rose from the fallen log she'd been sitting on, losing the smile as she addressed her prisoners. "Nobody goes anywhere," she said in Spanish, "and no talking." She turned and headed for the party, soon out of earshot. "Can you fetch me a bourbon and coke, honey?" said the Canadian. His name was Will. Matthew looked up from his plate of cold beans. Fortunately, Aida hadn't heard Will's crack, as she had absolutely no sense of humor. The six were seated on the ground in a circle around a small pile of black extinguished coals, the remnants of burned chusco firewood. The campfire had burned out an hour before, not to be relit till the morning. Earlier, Matthew and Will had spent 2 hours gathering wood while three gorillas almost 40 years younger stood guard and watched. The prisoners carried back plenty, but every stick of it had gone to the gorillas' fire in the smoky hut. The prisoners ate in silence. The Colombian woman was shivering from the cold. Matthew, too, was feeling a chill. A cool breeze was blowing down from the surrounding peaks, and the inescapable dampness only made it seem colder. A huge mosquito landed on Matthew's forehead, and he squished it. The mosquitoes in the Andes were the biggest he'd ever seen, but they were slow-moving and didn't seem to bite. Too cold for them, too. 20 meters away, the gorillas were getting louder and drunker. Two of them had a hand on Aida's ass, one on each side. "Any bets on which one she blows tonight?" said Will. No one answered. "What's the matter with you people? You hard of hearing?"
"Quiet," said Jan the Swede.
"Oh, so you can talk."
"Quiet, you fool. Don't make trouble for us while the gorillas are drinking."
"Ah, this is the biggest group of pussies I've ever met in my whole life."
He glanced at the Colombian woman as if to confirm that she didn't understand his English slang. Then he looked at Matthew and said, "With the possible exception of the fishermen here." "Nobody here's a pussy," said Matthew.
"That's not what you told me in the woods."
"I didn't tell you anything in the woods." He smiled.
"Got you there, didn't I, fisherman? Just a little joke. We're all going to go crazy if we don't have a few jokes."
Jan said, "Just shut up, will you please?"
The sudden crack of gunshot echoed in the valley. Another round followed, then two more. The gorillas shouted as if it were New Year's Eve. The drugs were kicking in. That was a sure bet when they started discharging their weapons like drunken cowboys. "Crazy bastards," said Will. He was speaking loudly, not caring who heard him. Jan glared. "I'm asking you nicely for the last time. Quiet, before you get us all in trouble."
"What are they going to do, take away a couple of beans from our dinner plate?"
"They can do plenty." This time it was Emilio, the voice of experience, the one who'd been kidnapped before. "Trust me, so far we've been well treated. It can get much worse."
"Stop talking," said Jan, "all of you."
"Why should we?" said Will. "Because Aida, the little bitch, says so?"
"No," said Matthew, "because she has a gun."
Across the camp, the two gorillas who had laid claim to Aida's ass were now arguing with each other, probably about whose turn it was tonight. These were the times that made Matthew most nervous, when teenage boys with raging hormones, automatic weapons, and basuco racing through their brains started arguing over a girl. Will glanced at the Swede and muttered, "They're a bunch of punks. You gotta stand up to them." Matthew intervened. "Easy, cowboy. Now's not the time to set them off." "I guess I pegged you wrong, fisherman. Thought you had balls."
"I also have brains."
"Are you calling me stupid?"
"I'm not calling you anything."
"Because if you want to see stupid, don't look my way. At least I wasn't dumb enough to write a letter home just because Joaquin tells me to."
Matthew did a double take.
Joaquin had pulled him into the hut to write the note, so he wasn't sure how Will knew. There's nothing stupid about putting my family at ease.
Fool, you're helping the gorillas, not your wife. The only purpose of that letter was to prove that you're still alive so the gorillas can demand a big fat ransom.
The Swede chimed in. What were we supposed to do, refuse?
Yes, I did.
They asked you to write a note to your wife and you said no?
Damn right. My wife and I had an understanding before I came to this country. If some commie-ass rebels kidnap me, don't pay the bastards a thing. No negotiation, no cooperation, period.
Behind them, there was a sudden stir in the bushes. Out walked Joaquin and two other armed guerrillas. They had been eavesdropping on the prisoners, as on that first day when Joaquin had hidden himself in the field to see if Matthew would try to escape. He stopped at the edge of their circle, then spoke to the Canadian.
Commie-ass rebels, eh?
Will said nothing.
Get up, said Joaquin.
Will looked around for support, but the others avoided eye contact. There was nothing anyone could do. Slowly he rose.
Your attitude needs improvement, said Joaquin.
I'll work on it, said Will.
I'll help you,
Joaquin said through a thin, sardonic smile. At his command, two guards rounded up the prisoners at gunpoint and followed Joaquin across the camp. They stopped at the stump where the gorillas had been playing stick'em with the knife. The blade was still stuck in the bark. Joaquin yanked it out, then called the other gorillas over from their party. Aida had the giggles, and two others were staggering. Each of them had a strained expression, as if struggling not to look too intoxicated in front of their leader. They gathered on one side of the stump, the prisoners on the other.
Put your hand here,
Joaquin told Will, pointing toward the stump. Will didn't budge. Matthew wasn't sure if he was refusing to move or simply frozen with fear. It didn't matter. With a nod from Joaquin, two gorillas grabbed Will, brought him forward, and placed his right hand on the stump, palm down.
Don't do this, said Will, his voice shaking. Spread the fingers, said Joaquin.
Please, I'm begging you, spread them,
Joaquin shouted,
or you lose all of them.
Will opened his hand, but not quickly enough. With a jerk, Joaquin forced the fingers as far apart as possible.
This isn't necessary, said Will, his voice growing tighter. I'll write that letter to my wife, if that's what you want. Of course you will, said Joaquin, with your other hand.
This ends Disc 3. A King's Ransom, Disc 4.
Standing and watching, Matthew knew that one man couldn't stop this. Still, he couldn't stand silent. It was a long shot, but he could think of only one possible angle in a country where 95% of the population was raised Roman Catholic.
God is watching, he shouted in Spanish.
The drunk snickered, but Joaquin didn't. Just for an instant, Matthew saw a flicker of hesitation in Joaquin's eye. It seemed to be saying that he wasn't of the same ilk as the other gorillas, that maybe he'd been raised with a conscience and had somewhere along the line taken a wrong turn, a very wrong turn. Joaquin shouted back,
"Shut up or you're next!"
He held the knife vertically, grabbing the handle like a ski pole and placing the tip between the prisoner's outstretched thumb and index finger. Slowly he raised it and brought it down carefully between the index and middle finger. Up again, then down between the middle and ring finger. Up and down once more between the ring and pinky finger, and then he started all over again between the thumb and index finger, a little faster this time, counting as he moved from one to the next.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro.
The gorillas watched, riveted. Most of the prisoners looked past the spectacle. All was silent, save for the tapping. With each move, the tip of the blade tapped against the stump, matching the rhythm of his count.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro. Tap, 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 tap.
Joaquin's face strained with concentration. His eyes grew wider. The pace quickened. The shiny blade moved from one position to the next, faster and faster still. The tapping became like machine gun fire, the counting like one long word. A wave of panic washed over Will's face as the gorilla's motion built to what seemed like a frenzy, back and forth, thumb to pinky, then back again. The knife was a blur, the tapping non-stop, the rhythm ever escalating. Until finally, a deafening shout pierced the silence. Matthew looked away, then back. The Canadian was rigid, motionless. It wasn't Will who'd screamed, it was Joaquin. He let out a second one, even louder, as he thrust his unbloodied knife triumphantly into the air. It was a game for him, and he'd won. His steady hand and coordination had prevailed. The Canadian's fingers had been spared, untouched by metal. Will was trembling. "Gracias," was all he could say, thankful still to have all his digits.
"Now, you try," said Joaquin.
Will looked around, not sure who Joaquin was talking to. "You mean me?"
"Yes, you."
Joaquin handed over the knife. Two gorillas aimed their assault rifles at Will's chest, just in case he had any ideas.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Exactly what I just did."
"I can't."
Joaquin removed a 9mm pistol from his holster.
"You will,"
he said flatly, aiming at Will's forehead. Will swallowed hard and acquiesced. He spread his fingers once more atop the stump. Matthew watched with his heart in his throat. Will grasped the knife firmly, though even from 15 feet away, Matthew could see it shaking in his hand. It seemed bigger, more unwieldy for Will. He started where Joaquin had started, with the tip of the long blade between his thumb and index finger. He left it there for several long, silent moments, afraid to move. Finally, Joaquin cocked his pistol.
"Begin."
Will drew a deep breath, then slowly moved the blade from the first position to the second, then to the third, the fourth.
"Rapido,"
said Joaquin. He picked up the pace. The tapping continued. A rhythm was building, though not as steady as Joaquin's. Will's eyes bulged, the intense concentration broken only by intermittent flashes of pain from the slightest of scratches. The first nick was to the ring finger, followed by several clean taps, then another glancing blow to a knuckle. Little white and crimson specks of flesh were starting to collect on the blade.
"Count it off. 1, 2, 3, 4. Rapido!"
Will was too breathless to count. Joaquin pressed the barrel of his pistol to the prisoner's forehead.
"Más rápido!"
Will turned it up a notch, his hand a blur, the tapping incessant, his breathing erratic, until he could maintain the pace no longer. The tapping ended with a thud, then a blood-curdling scream. It rolled across the mountain peaks, down into the valley, then returned in what seemed like 3 or 4 waves in a long, chilling echo. The knife was protruding from his hand, having made short work of the tender webbing between his thumb and index finger. Joaquin grabbed the handle and held the blade in place so that Will couldn't remove it from the wound without ripping the skin.
"Get it out!"
Joaquin held the blade firm. Then, in one quick motion, he jerked it down like a mini guillotine, adding a little hop to bring down the full force of his body weight. The bone snapped with a loud pop. Another scream followed, this one even worse than the other. The severed thumb rolled off the stump and landed at Joaquin's feet. Even the gorillas were stunned silent. Matthew started forward to help, but Aida trained her rifle on him, stopping him in his tracks.
"Por favor, he'll bleed to death."
The stump was soaked in red. Will was holding his bloody hand between his legs.
"You animal, you didn't have to do this to me."
Joaquin gave a signal to Aida, who then allowed Matthew to pass. Another gorilla tossed him an old gray scarf, which Matthew wrapped around Will's hand to stop the bleeding. The hand felt cold. His whole body was like ice, his face pale.
"He's going into shock," said Matthew. "We need more blankets."
No one moved.
"If he dies, you get no ransom," said Matthew.
Joaquin seemed torn, as if giving the man a blanket might undermine the point he'd been trying to make in front of the prisoners. But Matthew could see in his face that his own point about the ransom was hitting home. Joaquin finally gave the order, and one of the guards disappeared into the hut for some blankets. Will was shivering in Matthew's arms.
"It's going to be all right," Matthew said quietly. "Just hang in there."
Joaquin took the knife and gave it one last flick. The tip stuck perfectly into the tree stump. Then he picked up the severed thumb and held it up for the other prisoners to see.
"No need for Don William to write a letter now," said Joaquin. "His wife gets this."
The prisoners stood silent. Finally, the young mother in the group began to weep. Joaquin started to walk away, then stopped and addressed the group in a flat, matter-of-fact tone.
"Soon, I'll ask each of you to write another letter home. Not just to prove you're alive, but more important, to urge your families to pay your ransom. Write it. Write it with conviction."
He turned away and headed for the smoky hut. Matthew kept pressure on Will's bloody stump to control the bleeding. Part of him wanted to grab the knife and tell Joaquin that the Ray family would never pay either, but this man was evil, perhaps even psychopathic. There was no telling what he'd do to keep his prisoners in line, to squeeze a ransom out of their families. "Thank God I bought insurance," he thought, as the Canadian groaned once more in pain, his body growing colder in Matthew's arms. Chapter 19.
I wanted to see Grandma before going to Bogota. Maybe I was dreaming, but I was truly hopeful that the kidnappers would let me speak to Dad on the telephone once I got to Bogota. I wanted to be able to pass along at least one lucid thought from his mother.
On the day before my scheduled departure, I woke early and drove south to the Florida Keys, knowing that Grandma was better early in the morning. The Keys were better in the morning, too. Here, a ride down U.S. 1 in a topless jeep was the next best thing to boating. A series of bridges connected one small key to the next, with turquoise waters to the east and west. Sunrise was like a starting pistol for fishermen, though they moved out to sea at the pace of the tortoise, not the hare. The boats, some large, some barely big enough for a man and his catch, dotted the waters for miles. Another world. My normal AM commute would have found me stuck in traffic on my way downtown, car exhaust instead of fresh sea air. As I approached the old Red Cross cement home in which my father had been raised, I saw a young boy and his dad putting their boat into the water. It made me think back to my own childhood. My father and I had done that once. Once. One time in my whole life, my father had taken me fishing. Just the two of us. We'd never fully recovered. I was still hoping that someday we'd sort that out. Grandma was around back on the patio, seated at a cast aluminum table beneath a broad, shady umbrella. She invited me to join her for orange juice. That was a better start than last time when she'd thrown me out of the house. Better, though not perfect. She still called me Matthew, and obviously thought I was her son, but the nurse had a plan. She'd found an old photo album filled with pictures of Grandma and my father. My walking her through it might help clear her memory. I liked the idea. Grandma's mind was sharpest when trained on the distant past. For me, it was definitely an education. Some of the photos I'd never seen before.
"You were such a cutie," said Grandma, beaming. She was speaking of my father at a childhood birthday party.
"How old there?" I asked.
4. That was the year I gave you that fire truck. It didn't make it to your 5th.
So strange, I thought, this Alzheimer's disease. She could remember a gift given almost a half century ago, but she was too confused to realize that I was her grandson. Did I not take care of my things?
I wouldn't say that. You were just a boy. All boy.
A regular troublemaker, huh? She looked at me with sad eyes, laid her hand on mine.
No, honey. You didn't have to make trouble. It found us.
I wanted to follow up, but I was beginning to feel guilty about pretending to be my father. Was I being deceitful? Or was it an act of kindness toward an old woman who, for the first time in months, was holding a conversation that she could enjoy, that she could at least think was normal? "Who's that?" I asked, as I pointed to another photo.
"Your sister, of course."
Sister? I didn't have an aunt. I'd always thought Dad was an only child.
"Are you sure?" "I know my own children," she said sharply.
I didn't point out the irony. At the same time, I didn't dismiss her claim that this was her daughter. Where is she now?
Her eyes turned misty. Her hands began to shake. Why do you do these things to me? She said, her mouth tightening.
Do what?
She slammed the photo album shut. Playing with me that way? Do you enjoy this? Where is she today? She said, mocking my question. What kind of nonsense is that? I have a good mind to crack you across the head. No, both sides of the head.
I'm sorry.
Like hell, sorry. I don't give a damn if you're sorry.
The nurse appeared, having overheard the shouting.
Maybe we've had enough photographs for one morning.
We've had enough, Matthew. That's what we've had enough of. Who invited you here anyway? Go away. Get out of my yard, out of my house, out of my sight.
I couldn't move, neither my mouth nor my feet.
Go,
she screamed. The nurse took my elbow and I rose from the chair. Grandma folded her arms angrily across her bosom and looked away. I didn't know what to say, so I didn't say anything. My mind was a whirl as I walked alone to my Jeep. Her confusion had made it impossible to talk about the kidnapping, but strangely the outburst had made me realize the true purpose of my visit. I hadn't come to tell Grandma about my father. I was hoping she might tell me something about him. I drove away with a sinking sense that there was plenty to tell. Friday at lunchtime was a standing date with my buddy J.C. for basketball, and I needed to blow off some steam. We met at J.C. Park in the Gables, an outdoor court that J.C. fancied his home turf, given the similar-sounding name. Not to brag, but I was bigger and quicker than J.C., and whenever my outside shot was on, he couldn't stop me with a bazooka. Today, I was firing up air balls. We finished around 1 o'clock. J.C. had to get back to the office. As it was, he was one of the few stockbrokers I knew who would duck out for basketball before the market closed, but such was the level of commitment from a guy who told his clients to buy Heinz simply because he liked ketchup. He toweled off his sweaty head at courtside and packed up his athletic bag.
Not your day, huh?
Obviously not. The last time I lost 3 straight to you, I had a broken wrist from a skateboarding accident.
Sour grapes,
he said, then chugged his Gatorade. Normally another witty comeback would have been in order, but my heart wasn't in it. I was thinking about my trip. You mind checking in on my mother while I'm gone?
Sure, be glad to.
Thanks. He glanced at his watch, and I knew he was already late. We'd played longer than usual today, a nice gesture on his part to try to lift me out of the dumps. He laid a hand on my shoulder, looking at me with concern.
Have a safe trip. I mean that.
I will. He turned and headed for his car. I stayed behind and rested at the picnic table beneath a shady royal poinciana tree. For a moment, I was actually at peace, watching a giggling 4-year-old on the swing set nearby, her toes pointed and aiming for the sun. Every 3rd or 4th pump, she'd throw her head back until her long, curly hair almost touched the ground. Halfway through my Gatorade, I heard a voice behind me. Hello, Nick. I turned, surprised to see FBI agent Hewitt. What are you doing here?
It's a public park.
You don't look dressed for the monkey bars. How did you know I was here?
It's Friday lunch, isn't it? Basketball's your routine. You know how easy it is to find people when they live their lives in routines? It's one of the things kidnappers look for when choosing their victims. I'm sure your consultant has explained all that to you.
I wasn't sure how he knew about Alex. I didn't answer. He seated himself across from me at the picnic table, meeting me at eye level.
Consultants are full of all kinds of information and advice, aren't they?
I suppose. His gaze tightened.
Have you given any thought to what you and I talked about?
There's nothing to think about. My dad's not a criminal.
Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. What I'm telling you is he got mixed up with the wrong people. I'm giving you a chance to unscramble the egg.
Sorry. I just don't see it the way you do.
Maybe it's because you won't open your eyes.
I don't like the way you operate.
My father's been kidnapped, and the FBI won't help unless I snoop around his business and try to find something to incriminate his partner. You haven't given me a shred of evidence to raise my suspicions about my dad, his partner, or anyone in any way connected to Ray's seafood company. Pardon the pun, but you're on a fishing expedition, and I'm not biting. He drummed his fingers on the table and nodded, but not in agreement. I know your consultant. Alex is good as far as she goes, but she's steering you wrong here. I'm sure she's told you not to worry about the FBI. She's probably gone so far as to say you don't even need us. He leaned across the table, looked me straight in the eye. Let me tell you something, Nick. You need us more than you think. More than Alex knows. A lot more. He rose and said, "We'll be in touch." I watched as he cut across the park to his car. He walked in a perfectly straight line, eyes straight ahead. He didn't even notice the cute little girl on the swing, didn't return her wave as he passed her, probably didn't even hear her say hello to him. The hard-ass routine was evidently no act. Being a jerk came naturally. I grabbed my bag from the picnic table and walked to my Jeep. Chapter 20. Mom and I had a quiet dinner at home. She didn't ask much about my visit with Grandma, and I didn't tell her about my meeting with Agent Hewitt. The last thing I wanted to do was add to her worries the night before my flight to Bogota. We ate in the kitchen, a break with family tradition. When I was growing up, we always ate dinner in the dining room. That empty space at the head of the table, Dad's space, was something Mom didn't want to see. We sat on bar stools at the granite counter, both of us picking at a tuna casserole one of her friends had brought over. "You and Alex all ready to go?" she asked. "We're ready." "I figured as much. I'm sure she's done this many times." "Too many." Mom sipped her sparkling water. Her obstetrician had told her to cut out the caffeine, so San Pellegrino with lemon was now her drink of choice. "She doesn't think you'll be in the way, does she?"
"No."
"Are you sure?"
"Why would I be in the way?"
"You're another person she has to worry about."
"We've been over it a dozen times. Alex has told me what to wear, how to act, who to talk to, who not to talk to. She's handpicked our hotel. She's rented a car so we don't have to jump into taxis with strangers. Yesterday she sat down with me for an hour, going over what's safe and what's not safe. She even drew maps of the exact routes we'll travel. She used to live in Bogota. As long as I'm with her and listen to what she says, I'll be fine."
Mom didn't answer. It was her last shot at keeping me home, a feeble one at that. I decided to change the subject. "Did Dad have a sister?" She looked up from her plate, a little taken aback by the question. "What?"
"This morning, Grandma told me he had a sister."
"Your grandmother has Alzheimer's."
"I know, but she even showed me an old photograph of a girl about 5 or 6.
"Did she look like his sister?"
"Not especially."
"Could have been anyone, then."
"So he didn't have a sister?"
"None that he's ever mentioned to me. None that anyone's ever mentioned, including your grandmother, for the 25 years I knew her before she started slipping."
"Strange. She confuses me for Dad. Now she's created a missing daughter."
"She's probably thinking of your sister."
I thought for a second as I buttered a slice of bread. "When's the last time she saw Lindsay?"
"A long time, I suppose. But maybe your father planted some ideas in her head about Lindsay separating herself from the family."
"That's possible, I suppose."
"More than possible. For heaven's sake, your father's been missing for almost 2 weeks, and we still haven't even talked to Lindsay. We don't even know where she is."
That was the weirdest part with Grandma this morning. She totally blew a gasket when I asked her where this missing daughter was. She lashed out at me, at Dad in her mind, for even asking the question.
Mom poured herself more water. "She's a very confused woman right now."
"Yeah," I said, almost speaking to myself. "I'm pretty confused, too."
The telephone rang. Mom and I exchanged glances, and then I rose to answer. It was Alex.
"What's up?" I said.
Bad news, I'm afraid. Did something happen to my father? No, not that. Not directly, anyway. Mom was ashen. She'd heard my question. I covered the mouthpiece and told her Dad was fine, then continued with Alex. What is it, then? I'm afraid I won't be going to Bogota. Have you spoken to the kidnappers? Did they reschedule? No. The meeting's still on, as scheduled. I don't understand. Are you saying you want me to go alone? It's the insurance company pulled me off the case. Why? I can't get into that with you. I'm just calling to let you know I won't be accompanying you on your trip. So who's the replacement? She paused, seeming to struggle. There is none. Excuse me? I'm sorry, Nick. The insurance company is denying coverage on your claim. I gripped the phone, not quite comprehending. We have no negotiator? No. And the ransom will be paid by you. This is what I'm telling you. There is no coverage, no negotiator, no ransom. All of it denied. How can this be? I can't elaborate. I wasn't even supposed to call you. The insurance company is sending you official notice in accordance with the terms of the policy. Well, isn't that big of them? In less than 48 hours, I'm supposed to talk to my father's kidnappers by shortwave radio from the top of some hill in Bogota that I've never even heard of. Where the hell does this leave me? I can't answer that. Someone needs to answer it. This has to be a mistake. It's not a mistake. Who can I talk to? I would suggest the company's general counsel. The lawyers made the final call. My heart sank. I was hoping that this was some kind of administrative screw-up. Not likely if the lawyers had already approved the decision. Come on, Alex. There has to be something we can do. Believe me, I've done everything in my power. I truly hope you have better luck than I did. So that's it? You're bowing out? I'm sorry. What about my father? Goodbye, Nick. I couldn't even speak. The line clicked and the dial tone hummed in my ear. Finally, I turned at the sound of my mother's panicky voice. What just happened? I looked at her, stunned. I wish I knew, was all I could say. Part 2. Chapter 21. I reached Miami International Airport at 6 a.m., 2 hours before my flight. Even if I'd known how to contact the kidnappers, I wouldn't have dared to reschedule our first meeting. I'd done my homework. I was prepared psychologically and logistically. Everything was set. With or without insurance, I was going to Bogota. End of story. I'd represented enough insurance companies to know that I wasn't about to resolve a coverage dispute overnight, so I didn't even try. I did call Duncan Fitz, however, and told him exactly what Alex had said. He seemed like the right person to get things moving in my absence. Since Quality Insurance was a major client of Cool Cash, he couldn't be adversarial and browbeat them into reversing their position, but Duncan felt confident that he could at least make an inquiry and elicit a more detailed explanation of their about-face. We agreed to powwow when I got back and figure out where I stood. I checked in at the crowded international terminal, then found a seat and killed some time reading a Spanish-language magazine called Semana. One of the things Alex had told me was to blend into the Colombian culture while traveling. I left my Sports Illustrated and John Grisham novels at home. Another piece of advice was never to let go of my travel bag. I kept it right at my side. Interestingly, the baggage tag was still on it from the last time I checked it on a flight home from LaGuardia to Miami International. MIA, the airport abbreviation read, which in this context struck me as ironic. I wondered if I would end up MIA, missing in action. The bag was filled with maps and travel books, things I didn't dare pull out in public and effectively announce to the world that I was a naive American tourist traveling alone to Colombia. I'd already read all of them several times, anyway. The travel hype made Bogota sound vaguely like Miami, sophisticated in some segments, crude and violent in others. It boasted futuristic architecture and old colonial churches, world-class museums that showcased everything from pre-Columbian to contemporary art. It was a vibrant mix of all things Colombian, culturally diverse, an intellectual center, its busy streets a forum for the daily clash between rich and poor, pack mules and Porsches. There was no shortage of great restaurants, either. It seemed like a city I might have actually liked to visit,
under different circumstances, save for one glaring statistic. Every hour, someone got killed. Some deaths were accidents, but as many as 8 a day were homicides. More if you counted at least a portion of the 2,500 annual deaths from unknown causes. The confirmed homicides alone added up to an annual murder rate higher than that in Miami, New York, Atlanta, and Los Angeles combined. I turned my thoughts back to restaurants. 40 minutes before the flight, the airline made the first boarding call, first class only. The entire waiting area started toward the gate. That was another tidbit Alex had shared. "Don't expect South Americans to queue up like a bunch of Brits," she'd said. "Wherever you are, airport, movie theater, bus station, act like you're on the Titanic and they're loading the last lifeboat." When in Rome, I figured. I joined the mob at least 20 minutes before my row would officially be called for boarding. Through the crowd, an attractive Latina woman caught my eye. She was standing at the check-in counter, her travel bag draped over her shoulder. She wore a stylish, short-waisted leather jacket and jeans that fit extremely well. Her face was partially hidden beneath the broad rim of a felt hat, but what little I caught of her profile was promising. She finished with the airline attendant, then turned and shot me a discreet sideways glance. I definitely wasn't looking for it, but even my travel book had mentioned that there was more to Colombia's beauty than just countryside. She started walking toward me, pushing through the semblance of a line, and then it registered. The long hair had been tucked up beneath the hat, and I hadn't recognized her. "Alex?" I said. "Surprise. What are you doing here?" "I'm going with you." "Wow," I thought. "Duncan works fast. What happened?" Clearly, she didn't want to talk in the crowd. Neither did I. We gave up our places in line and moved to an open space near the finger-smudged window that looked out on our Boeing 767. "Did the insurance company change its tune?" I asked. "No, they're denying your claim. I had a long chat with their general counsel after you and I talked yesterday evening. My sense is that they're never going to change their minds." "Then why are you here?" "Because I think you're getting a raw deal." "I'm glad someone sees it my way." "It's hard for me as a professional to see it any other way. It's unethical what the insurance company did to you, pulling out just hours before your flight leaves for Colombia." "How are you handling this with them?" "I still need to think that through. I figured I'd get you through this first go-round with the kidnappers and then sort things out. I'd like to be able to pay your normal fee, but now that I'm without insurance, I'm worried about how I'm going to cover the ransom." "For now, let's just say this trip is a freebie." "We'll figure out something. Maybe you can give me some free legal services someday." "Thank you." "No problem. All I ask is 2 things. One, from this moment forward, you don't utter the word insurance." "Done." "What's the second thing?" She smiled wryly. "Try not to embarrass me in my home country." "How would I embarrass you?" "You're a gringo. You'll find a way. Just remember the advice I gave you yesterday. No se puede dar papaya." I looked that up in my phrase dictionary, and it still doesn't make sense to me. It means you can't give papaya. She shook her head, still smiling. "It's an expression, genius. It means don't let your guard down. Don't give anyone a chance to take advantage of you." "Good advice. Come on, let's get back in line." We started back toward the mob. Even the pushing and shoving at the gate seemed to be less of a hassle with Alex on my team. My spirits were up, and with the challenges ahead, I sorely needed the boost. I looked at her and said, "I'm glad you're back on the case." "Well, you do need a negotiator." "I know I do, and I'm glad it's you. I think my father would like you." "I think I'd like him, too." "Because of all those great things I told you about him?" "No. Because the apple usually doesn't fall far from the tree. And I happen to think his son is a pretty great guy." "Thank you. For a lawyer." "Ouch." "You're welcome." She gave me a little wink, then nudged me forward. Together we pushed toward the gate, just me, Alex, and 200 Colombians. Chapter 22. Our car was a clunker.
It wasn't even from a rental agency. One of Alex's friends loaned us a rusty Chevy Vega with 89,000 miles and worn-out shocks. It was part of her low-profile strategy. No fancy car, no wads of cash, no jewelry or wristwatch, except my $19 swatch. And I could forget those nice restaurants I'd been reading about. At least, we'd booked a reputable hotel.
Hotel? She said with a chuckle as we left the terminal. I borrowed a flat from Pablo for a couple days.
Pablo was the guy who'd loaned us the car that was now limping down the highway. What about my reservations at the Bogota Royale?
You didn't really think we were staying there, did you?
Yeah.
Just a diversion. If someone comes looking for us, we won't be there.
I thought she was joking, but she wasn't smiling. You're thinking someone would be following us?
They grabbed your father. Obviously, someone thinks your family has money.
I suddenly felt vulnerable. I reached over and locked the passenger door. She drove, and I rode in the glove compartment. That was what it seemed like, anyway. The passenger seat was stuck in the forwardmost position so that my knees pressed up against the dash. The ride was bumpy, too many potholes for our little rust bucket. We made decent time out of the Aeropuerto El Dorado, but traffic clogged as we headed east into the city. The drive from the airport was a foreigner's first taste of lawlessness in Bogota. Horns blasting, red lights ignored, sudden maneuvers to avoid collisions, all performed to the endless symphony of vulgar gestures and the most violent insults ever hurled between motorists. Yesterday, I'd been skeptical upon reading that each day 3 pedestrians were run over and killed by buses in Bogota, to say nothing of the casualties caused by some 900,000 private automobiles. Now that I'd arrived, I was beginning to think they'd understated the carnage. Sometime after 2 p.m., we finally reached downtown. The cool, thin air surprised me. Bogota was closer to the equator than Miami was, but the city was nestled high in a mountain basin against the jagged ranges of the Cordillera Oriental, about the same altitude as Aspen, Colorado. With over 6 million people, it was an aggressive metropolis. The mountains bordered the east. Wealthy expansion had moved north. Poorer housing and industry were to the south and west. The old city's center was still vibrant, though some of the colonial buildings were in disrepair. At its best, the feeling was Madrid or New York, especially the old commercial center. There were impressive skyscrapers, wide boulevards, trendy shops, and well-dressed professionals walking with the ubiquitous cell phones. The air was thick with exhaust from plenty of clunkers and some nice cars, too, more than I'd expected. Of course, there were beggars at the intersections. Sad, but street poverty was a fact of life in virtually every city in South America, not just Bogota. The atmosphere didn't strike me as overwhelmingly friendly, but it wasn't especially scary either. Then we turned the corner and saw the rubble. Beside a bank was a huge pile of loose bricks, broken concrete, twisted metal. Cleanup crews were shoveling shattered glass and burned-out furnishings into wheelbarrows and dump trucks. The skeletons of 3 scorched cars were still on the sidewalk, one of them upside down. The work area was secured with rope and barricades. A handful of uniformed officers stood guard, but the investigation appeared to be over. They were just sweeping up the mess.
"Last week's car bombing," said Alex.
"Terrorists?"
"Claro."
"Who?"
"Who knows? It's at least the 10th one this year."
I wanted to be open-minded and say something like, it could happen anywhere, but a bombing every month? This wasn't Madrid or New York, this was Bogota, and once I'd seen the first sign of terrorism, I seemed to become more critical of everything else, or perhaps just more observant. A beggar approached our car at the next intersection. He was just a kid, his face and hands dirty, his clothes practically rags. This time I didn't just look past him, I looked right into his eyes. His face pressed against the passenger window. They were black, empty eyes. I noticed 2 other boys on the curb passing a big bottle of glue between them, sticking the nozzle up their nostrils. One looked right at me, but I honestly couldn't say that he saw me. He had that same vacant expression.
Foreigners heard so much about Colombia and its drugs, but no one seemed to talk about the 8-year-old kids on the streets, blowing their brains out with industrial-strength fumes. The traffic light changed, and we were on our way. Our meeting with the kidnappers wasn't until tomorrow evening. By arriving a full day early, we were sure not to miss it over a logistical problem like a flight delay or goats in the road. So far, everything had gone without a hitch, which left us the rest of the day and a full day tomorrow with nothing to do. I thought I'd take the time to visit one of the organizations I'd been communicating with by internet, Fundación País Libre, a private foundation whose main mission was to raise public awareness of Colombia's kidnapping epidemic and to push for reform. With their headquarters just blocks away, I felt rude not stopping by to thank them for the information they'd sent me.
Skip it, said Alex.
Why?
Because any time I'm in Colombia to negotiate with kidnappers, my basic rule is to trust no one.
Not even the foundation?
No one.
I don't have to tell them I came here to talk to the kidnappers.
What are they going to think? Your father was kidnapped by guerrillas, so you decided this would be a dandy spot for a vacation?
No, they'll think I came all the way to Bogota because my family is pursuing every possible angle to make sure my father is released as quickly as possible. How can that hurt?
Look, I'm not putting down the foundation. They do a lot of great things, but keep in mind that they helped push for the passage of Colombia's anti-kidnapping law in the early 90s. One of the things that law did was make it illegal for the families of kidnapped victims to pay ransom.
You mean if we pay a ransom, we're breaking the law?
Don't worry. That part of the law was declared unconstitutional by the Colombian Supreme Court. The government still opposes the payment of ransom, but I've done everything we need to do to make sure the authorities look the other way.
What does that mean?
It means that you can't begin to understand the scope of the kidnapping and ransom problem in this country, and I don't want you making side trips to talk to people at the foundation or anywhere else. From now until the time we leave, I'd prefer that you stay within my line of sight.
Come on, Alex. I appreciate all you're doing for me, and probably a little paranoia is understandable, but you're starting to sound worse than me.
She suddenly turned angry.
You want to see paranoid? I'll show you.
She steered down a side street and stepped on the gas. The tires squealed as the little car cornered up a winding road to the top of a steep hill. Minutes later, we stopped at the side of the road where the view of the valley was unobstructed for a good square mile. She stepped down from the car, and I followed her to the edge of the cliff. Below was a residential neighborhood, hundreds of middle and upper-middle-class homes on the wealthy north side of Bogota.
Look, she said.
We had a bird's-eye view of the rooftops. The houses were nice, but they were little fortresses. Security walls surrounded each home, some topped with razor wire. Dobermans roamed many of the properties. Dozens had guards posted along the walls or at the doors, like sentries, armed with automatic rifles. When I was a little kid, this neighborhood was like the one you grew up in. Kids could ride their bicycles. Mothers could stroll with their babies. Hard to believe, isn't it? I nodded slowly, taking it in. That green house on the corner, she said, pointing. FARC has their 22-year-old son. The yellow house, 5 doors down. They took a father of 3. Shot him in the head 6 months later when he tried to escape, then came back and snatched his 8-year-old daughter while his widow was out making the funeral arrangements. That 2-story house on the hill over there.
Okay, enough, I said.
Reading the País Libre statistics was one thing. Seeing where the victims actually lived was quite another. These aren't drug dealers. They aren't even super-rich people. They're normal families who worked hard to have a decent home and a few nice things. Bankers, shop owners, lawyers like you. This is the way they have to live now. I noticed her voice tightening. Obviously, this wasn't easy for her to talk about. If you want to wander around Colombia against my advice, Nick, don't do it while you're my responsibility. I looked at her, then back at the fortified homes. I'm sorry, I said softly.
Let's go. We got back into the car, neither of us saying a word. What I'd seen had definitely made an impact. Certainly there was every reason to take precautions.
As she'd said in the airport, no se puede dar papaya. But her refusal to stay at a hotel or drive a rental car seemed a bit overboard to me, not to mention her going so far as to make a phony hotel reservation purely as a diversion to would-be followers. And her fears of an organization like Fundación País Libre seemed almost irrational. The ignition whined, then screeched, and finally the car started. As Alex struggled to find first gear, I was starting to wonder, maybe she was being extra careful for my benefit. She feared for the safety of the gringo. Then again, maybe it was Alex herself who was hiding from someone. I glanced back once more toward the houses in the valley, then tucked my knees against the glove box as she drove us back into the city. Chapter 23. Two things struck me about television in Colombia. Well, one thing, really. I suppose I'd expected the daily toll of violence on the evening news. Murders, kidnappings, muggings. You could get that in Miami. But the nudity was the real shocker. Not in the programs, but the commercials. To be sure, American TV had its share of scantily clad models selling beer, cars, cologne, but American ads were puritanical by Colombian standards. With the amount of flesh flashing here, who needed the Spice Channel? Television was about all I saw during my first 8 hours in Bogota. Alex had me holed up in our flat all day. It wasn't a bad place, actually, but by 8 o'clock I was feeling claustrophobic. "Want to get some dinner?" said Alex. "You mean go out?" "Yeah." "Really?" I said, teasing. "I thought you'd have me disguise my voice and order pizza under an alias." "Very funny." I smiled, but in truth, I needed to get out. Watching television in my distant second language was tiresome, and I found myself slipping into non-productive worries about my father. "Let's go," I said. We drove north of downtown to a trendy area.